The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So, hello. So today I want to talk about perfection and imperfection in relationship to this practice that we do. And one of the little take-homes I hope to take with you, because it's a little slogan, is the idea that it's better to be righted than it is to be right. And this is a nautical reference. Sailboats, maybe most of you know this, all of you know it maybe, but sailboats that have a keel, a strong tempest, a wind can come and push the sailboat over towards the side, tip it quite far. But it's because the keel is quite heavy, the more it gets tipped, the more the keel kind of is heavy in a sense and counters the force of the wind or the waves. And then the keel rights the boat. And boat comes to standing, a righted boat, one that stands more or less, the mast is vertical again. And boats are being tossed around in the sea, sailboats, and they're constantly being, you know, righted. And therefore they don't capsize, usually. So there's a wonderful expression, to be righted is to come back into balance, to come back and to be upright. So this little slogan is, it's better to be righted than to be right. Where being right means that, you know, that you are right with your opinions, you're right with what you do, you're kind of justified, you defend yourself, you have an opinion that you feel is the true opinion and everyone else should know it, or you're going to defend it at all costs. And so one has to do with some idea. And ideas come and go. But the first has to do with your disposition, how you actually are, as opposed to what you believe and what you think. So it's better to be righted than to be right. And so the practice is to help right us. Practice provides a keel, a ballast that keeps us come back up. And we'll get tossed around by the waves of life all the time. But if we have a keel, something like that, we'll become righted. And that's part of the function of mindfulness, is that it's partly functions as a keel, just to know, the clarity of knowing what's happening begins that movement to be righted, to be come back up straight, upright or something. So that's kind of a little bit one of the takeaways I'm hoping you'll understand by this talk. So, but the theme perfection and imperfection is that the Buddhist tradition, if you listen to teachers and read about it and the ancient texts, is that it lends itself, or has a kind of a shadow side, or lends itself to this idea of perfection. And that there's you're trying to attain something perfectly. And I think it's most represented idea that someone is fully enlightened. Here we have the word fully enlightened. There's partially enlightened, there's a fully enlightened, or perfectly enlightened. The Buddha was said to be perfectly enlightened. That if someone gets fully enlightened, they have overcome all suffering. They free themselves from all suffering. You know, there's no room for suffering then. That's perfect, perfectly free of suffering. Someone has perfectly freed themselves from all their defilements, all their attachments. And then well short of this kind of idea of perfection is the idea that there's like perfect meditation experiences. For mindfulness practitioners, you can be completely in the present moment without the mind wavering whatsoever, perfectly present. Or people who do concentration practice, you can enter into deep states of concentration where the mind does not waver, does not get distracted into any kind of distraction, and you can be perfectly there. All these things, I believe, are true. It's possible to attain all these things, but it sets up a big shadow side or downside, where people then are measuring themselves against the perfect standard. And, you know, I'm supposed to be perfect. I'm supposed to manage just, you know, not have to have any problems here. And I'm not supposed to waver. I'm not supposed to be distracted. I'm not supposed to have any attachment. And heaven forbid that I come to a Buddhist center and show anger. Because anger is like one of our, you know, like, that's not being kind. And so the shadow side of Buddhist organizations like ours is that people sometimes are kind of hold in check their anger because you're supposed to be kind here. And so people don't, you know, like admit that they're angry or they hold it back or they do something. And so the shadow side is we have this imperfect side that then we deny, we hide, we push away, and we're trying to hold it up perfectly. When I was a Zen student, there was this idea that there was something to some way of being. There was an it that was never defined. But if you knew it, then everything was good. And some people knew it, and some people did, you know. But you know, I never knew it. So, and so there was this kind of strange, kind of mythic thing going on that was kind of being held in the community that I don't know how many people, even the teachers, understood how much this mythic idea, which was undefined, was kind of people are measuring themselves again and hope against and holding themselves up that this is supposed to attain. Some people have felt the same thing with the Vipassana tradition that we're in, that there's this mythic idea of Nibbana, this great attainment. But they never quite understand, what is this? What do they keep talking about? But, you know, I don't have it, and so I'm not, you know, really up to snuff. You know, somehow I'm kind of lesser than. And then there's the projection, when there's this ideal of perfection, then there's a projection of perfection on others. There's certainly that person, that teacher, that practitioner must have it all together, and you know, that's the perfect example of how it's supposed to be. And or maybe close to perfect or something. And so, yeah, the teacher picks his nose, but, you know, but mostly it's like, you know, pretty good. And so this whole perfection thing can be a headache, can be a problem. It can also be inspiring. And some people are motivated as a kind of North Star, or this is possible, and this is the direction I'm going. So it's part and parcel of this Buddhist tradition that we're part of, this ideal of perfection. We can't get around it. And the Buddha, in the centuries after he lived, his perfection kept growing. And if you watch the growth, the historical literature that was produced in ancient India, describing the Buddha, you see how he began more or less as a human being, and he slowly became more and more something was closer to a deified being, a perfect being, and with greater and greater powers and abilities. And part of how my interpretation of this is that in that culture of ancient India where he was at, it was kind of required that a spiritual leader, spiritual founder, that no one could be, he couldn't be, it was usually he, right? No one could be second best to him. So if there was another teacher who had some ability that was greater than the Buddha, then the Buddha wasn't so great. And so whenever there was some new person in town who had some ability, the Buddhist texts would always describe how the Buddha was even better. And so it just grew and grew, this grandiosity of the Buddha, you know, like until, you know, he would visit heavens and fly through the air and, you know, all kinds of. My favorite little story that from 1,000 years after the Buddha is written in a famous text called The Path of Purification, is there are ancient texts that talk about the Buddha going into the river to bathe. Well, this is a big problem, because a Buddha, by the nature of being a Buddha, never gets dirty. It's always clean. It's impossible for a Buddha to be dirty. So why is a Buddha going into bathing? They have to explain it now. And so they explain it, well, it's just for the sake of other people to understand that it's useful to bathe. Something like that. And so, you know, the Buddha wasn't even allowed to be human, you know, dusty India, walking around in the hot season and getting dirty, because that's not just doesn't happen to someone as perfect as a Buddha. So we have that ideal also that's at play and going on. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I guess, or the other, we have imperfection, which is kind of us. It's a few of us. I don't want to speak for all of you. But, you know, there's a little bit of, you know. There's a famous story of Suzuki Roshi, the teacher, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, who said, he talked to his students, when I look upon you, I see all of you as perfect, but there's room for improvement. And so that was, you know, a very generous kind of way of looking at people. And there's room for improvement. So we have ways in which we're wounded psychologically in our hearts, the ways in which we have attachments and fears and desires that catch us. We're caught in resentments. There's ways in which our minds function in many diverse ways. And now we call some people neurodiverse, rather than calling them, they have an illness or some kind of deficiency. We now recognize people are neurodiverse. They have all these different ways of operating, which is much more generous than how it used to be when people were seen as being somehow deficient because of their ways their brain was constructed. And I really saw this wonderfully in my kids' elementary school classes. And so I got to see all these diverse kids in a way I'd never seen human beings before. They kind of stood out in their differences and their sensitivities and their uniquenesses. And how luckily in that school they all had a place and were kind of well cared for. When I was growing up, they would have been sent to detention or, I don't know, or been expelled from the school or something, because people had no idea what was going on 40, 50 years ago. So rather than seeing, used to be things where people were imperfect, now we see there's more, perfection is more different ways of being a human being, which is kind of wonderful. And maybe you're more perfect than you realize. Maybe you're kind of unique in your ways and how things operate for you. And one of the ways of, rather than thinking of yourself as being imperfect against an external standard, you get to just be yourself. Wouldn't that be nice? So the practice, we have these, but we have shortcomings. And that was my favorite word when I was a new practitioner. You know, I have these shortcomings. And one of the challenges when I was a Zen student, for me personally, was that the practice was being presented as a practice of just being present in the moment, radical acceptance of this moment, without trying to attain anything or any goal or anything you're trying to do except be here. And it, in some ways, it was a wonderful practice. I loved it. At the same time, I saw I had these shortcomings. And at some point, I became the gardener of the monastery. And as a gardener, I would pull out weeds so that other things could grow. And I looked at that, I thought, wait a minute, if I do this for the garden, isn't it natural to do that for my mind as well? Don't I have weeds in my mind? And isn't it a normal, natural thing to take those weeds out? And so I struggled with that because of the Zen teaching seemed to not make room for that until I came to kind of the understanding that removing weeds was not really... was a natural thing to do. It wasn't like... I was so focused on goals or attainments, which is like, if there's a weed, you take it out, kind of more. If you have a weed in the mind, it's fine to take it out. And for me, the primary one that was a big issue was anger. And so I would have to, you know, work with, you know, I saw there's that anger, and do I just let it simmer and be there, or do I find a way to work with it and practice with it? And so what I came to was to appreciate that I had actually a lot of shortcomings. And I got to see that every time I noticed a shortcoming, I would be happy. Not because I had it, but because I had a practice to meet it. This was the compost, this was the fertilizer for doing the practice. If I had been perfect with no shortcomings, I wouldn't have had any fertilizer for the practice. And so I learned to be happy, kind of to recognize. I wasn't content. It wasn't a happiness, okay, now I'm just going to have a shortcoming. The world has to deal with it now because, you know, I'm just going to accept myself and, you know, go out into the world and do my funny things my mind wants to do. It wasn't that. It was rather this emphasis on practice. And this idea that I take refuge in the practice. Sometimes my shortcomings were difficult, my attachments, my fears, whatever it was. But I knew I had this practice, and I took refuge in the practice. Okay, I don't know how to do it, I don't know how we're going to get through this, but I have a practice, I trust this practice. And so this idea of appreciating shortcomings rather than being embarrassed by them or shamed by them. And many people are shamed, many people are embarrassed, many people hide them, even from themselves, because somehow you're not perfect, you're not like living up to some ideal. The ideal that I would like us to live in, which maybe is dangerous to say, because maybe there shouldn't be ideals like this, but the ideal is that it's okay to have a shortcoming if you practice with it. And it's okay to admit you have a shortcoming if you practice with it. And that was one of the wonderful experiences I had in this outer hall here many years ago. We had a meeting here of the most senior Zen teachers here in the San Francisco area. Some of them have been practicing for 40 years or something. And it was just kind of a personal time together. I don't know how many there were, 15 of them or so, sitting in a circle. And so they went around. At some point, the question was, what are your challenges these days? And they went around, and they had all these ordinary challenges that beginning meditators would have. Like, you know, you can probably guess what they were. You know, some of them had fear. They talked about being nervous and afraid or anxious about certain things. And they just went, they all had their thing. But what was remarkable, that I'd never seen in such a collection of people, they were completely at ease and relaxed about having their shortcoming. It was clear that they were practicing with it and being sincere with it and trying to do their best, but they were so at ease, at least with it, you know, oh, you know, when I give Dharma talks, I'm so anxious. you know, like they were smiling. whatever. So the Buddha, partly the inspiration for this talk was that I read recently a sutta discourse, ancient discourse of the Buddha, where he has this teaching. He distinguishes two kinds of people, the awful people and the excellent people. And exactly how these two Pali words are supposed to be translated is controversial, but one translator does inferior and superior people. But that doesn't work very well for me or for much of the modern audience, I think. But the word kind of means more like awful and excellent. That's more closer to the literal meaning. So then it's going to describe how that works. Who are the awful people? Who are the excellent people? And it has to do with whether or not they have a blemish, a shortcoming, a fault of some kind. So you might think that it would be that the people who have the fault, the blemish, they're the awful people. And the people who have no blemish, they're the excellent people. But that's not what the Buddha says. Instead, he says, it's the people who have a blemish and don't know it. They're the awful people. The people who have a blemish and know they have it are the excellent people. And he goes on to say, and the people who don't have a blemish and don't know it are awful. And the people who don't have a blemish and know it, they're wonderful, they're excellent. So probably each of you should retranslate those two words into words that work better for you than awful and excellent. So don't take them too serious. But there's a distinction here, and clearly the ideal is not to be free of blemish, but rather to know how it is, how you are. That's what's excellent. And so here you're allowed to have a blemish by the Buddha, if you know it. And because if you know it, then you can practice. If you don't have a blemish and don't know it, then you can easily slip off into delusion, into attachments again. But if you know you don't have a blemish, then you can a little bit appreciate that state and practice with that and grow in it and develop it. So I'm just delighted by this idea of knowing that you have blemishes, knowing that you're imperfect, knowing perhaps in some ways that you failed. And now we come to one of the central pieces of the culture of the United States that some of you maybe can appreciate, and that's baseball. At the center of American culture is a sport that mostly involves failure. Someone who fails only two-thirds of the time when they're at bat is an excellent player. And they're mostly failing. And they just come up to bat again and again and again. So failure, blemishes, maybe we don't have to take them so seriously. Maybe it's okay to have shortcomings and faults. And if we practice with it, if we engage in it, and one of the ways to practice with it is to know that it's present, to know our shortcomings. And the knowing is mindfulness. And the knowing is how we right the ship, how the ship rights itself. Whether we think about a sailboat, is that the sailor usually doesn't do the righting. It's a big sailboat can tip over, but then everyone holds on, and then the boat rights itself. Usually, and so the knowing. So what is it about knowing that helps right our ship? And one of the things is that the clarity of knowing means that in the clear time of knowing, we're not participating in the shortcoming. We have it, but we're not engaged in it. We're not identified with it. We're not barreling ahead with it. So if we're angry and say, oh, wow, I am angry right now. There's anger here right now. That's very different than continuing ruminating about all the reasons you're angry with some situation and planning revenge. But then you're really kind of, even if you kind of know that you're angry, but you're really kind of sunk into it versus kind of stepping back and say, oh, this is anger. It's kind of like now you're making space for something else to operate that rights the ship. You're making space that there's more of you there. There's breathing room. There's space to expand into, to relax into. Oh, it's like this for me. As soon as you then say, well, I guess I'm imperfect and I got to get perfect quickly. This is wrong. I'm a bad person because I'm angry. Then we're piling winds upon winds upon the sails. We keep pushing it over. We're adding second arrows or third arrows, as we say in Buddhism. We are just adding more suffering. The way to not add suffering is to appreciate and learn the simplicity of knowing. Just be mindful, clear, oh, this is how it is. And then to have a practice that works with it. that could be as simply as, now that I know it's there, let me know it again. Let me feel it. Let me really see how it's like. Let me kind of name it, and so that there's an honesty, self-honesty. Oh, it's like this. A lot of people are not honest with themselves about what's going on. And in Buddhism, we're trying to be honest. Oh, that's how it is. Maybe we practice relaxation. Maybe it's time to practice breath meditation so we're not so caught in the grip of something. But it's not with the idea that we're doing something wrong exactly, that we're bad. There's no bad people. There might be bad thoughts, bad impulses, you know, that are harmful. But we don't have to bury ourselves in shame or regrets or upset criticism of ourselves because we have a practice. Oh, I see it. This is how it is. Let me practice with this now. Let me find my way with it. Let me see if there's another way of holding this than holding it with resentment or shame. Can I hold it with kindness? Can I have a generous attitude towards this challenge that I have? Can I just see it as this is part of me, but it's not who I am. It's a part of me that I'd like to address and work with and find some freedom from. But I'm not going to give it I'm not going to be held hostage by it. I'm not going to be trapped by it. But I'm going to be untrap myself through the practice of mindfulness. Some of these shortcomings we have might remain, but with time, they don't hinder us, they don't grab us, they don't take over, they don't possess us. So there might be fear, there might be strong desires, there might be anger. That kind of accompanies us. Oh, there you are, anger. I know you're there, but you're not going to... I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to do anything based on it. I'm free enough to now live my life unhindered by it. But I know it's there. The attitude that immediately sees a shortcoming, a fault that we have, as being terrible, wrong, to identify I'm that terrible person because I'm angry, means that we've kind of put that anger center stage and become possessed by it. The mindfulness practice can put it in its right place, which is just a piece of the whole picture. And just a piece of it means that we don't have to be maybe caught by it or limited by it. So the very fact that we have a shortcoming doesn't have to be a big deal. It becomes oftentimes a bigger deal than it actually is because we're reacting to it or judging ourselves because of it. Instead of judging ourselves or defining ourselves by the shortcoming, just smile and say, hey, today I have a shortcoming. Isn't that great? Someone asks you, why are you happy? You're smiling a lot today. Oh, because I'm so anxious. What? You're anxious and you're smiling? Oh, yes, because I know I'm anxious and I have this practice. It's not easy to be with anxiety, but I'm so glad I have this practice. Is this crazy? Yeah? Somebody nodding? It's a kind of a shift of perspective how we hold ourselves and see ourselves. So the last thing I'll say is that this practice that we do, the practice of mindfulness, is so valuable, it's even valuable when we just do it partially. It's so valuable, it's even valuable when we do it imperfectly. And I suspect that a few of us, occasionally, will do it imperfectly. The This is a family joke that I had. Saying that, it's kind of like an ancient family joke. We used to go skiing when I was a kid. And at some point, my father used to joke, and he'd say, I almost fell today on the ski slopes. Of course he fell, but it was like almost, you almost had a shortcoming. So to practice with it, to admit it, to see it, to not be weighed down by all these uniqueness and foibles that we have. So you might consider, if you understand what I'm saying here, you might consider what nice word you have for your own oddities. For me, when I was younger, I called it my shortcomings. You might call it foibles. You might call it oddities. You might call it your friends. What do you want to call it that is a little bit kinder and more supportive for you than call it a fault or a problem? You have a word?
I do. Mistake.
Mistakes.
Yeah, mistakes.
Mistakes. Okay, so call it a mistake rather than calling it wrong. Idiosyncrasies. Do you have some of those? Many. What other good words are there?
Illusion.
Illusion or delusion?
Delusion.
Delusion. Some people like that. Great. Just delusion. Yeah.
I call it my way.
My way. Yes?
My habits.
Habits. My habits.
I mean my Roberta.
Say?
Roberta!
Wabi sabi.
Eccentricities.
Louder, please.
Eccentricities.
No, I still.
Eccentricities.
And eccentricities. Eccentricities.
All of the above.
All of the above. Life. This is life. The full catastrophe. So, it's a wonderful thing to have a practice. And it allows us to have a whole different perspective on the challenges of our life. And there are other challenges in life besides our foibles, our shortcomings. Life itself is a challenge. The tragedies of life, the losses of life that we all live with. Life is not perfect. Some of us are aging. Some of you haven't gotten around to it yet. But at least to recognize it. Aging is not an accident. You know, it's just this is how we're built to age. That's what's how human beings are created. It's not a mistake. So we have these tragedies, we have these challenges, we have all kinds of things that come besides our shortcomings. And we have a practice. And we meet everything with practice. And take refuge in the practice is to find your freedom in the midst of everything. It's a fantastic thing to have. And if you have a refuge, you have that kind of refuge, there's no need to complain about anything. Because you can just practice with it instead. So may you take refuge in the practice. If that's too high a bar, maybe for some of you, is to take refuge in your sincerity, your sincere effort to practice. Because maybe your practice can't be perfect, but maybe your sincerity can be sincere to do your best. So thank you, everyone, for today. And for some of you, if you'd like, we can go now and meet in the parking lots and sit in the street. You want to have a little discussion about it, this or anything at all, and take off our masks out in the parking lot if you'd like. You don't have to. If you'd like to do that, there's the folding chairs that are out in the cabinet there just outside in the other room. Bring a folding chair if you can, or someone else will bring a couple, and we'll make a circle out there in the parking lot in a few minutes, and we'll have a little discussion, and I look forward to being with any of you that decide to stay. Thank you.